before the across the park or around.
The most exciting thing you can start a show with.
Coming live from the 2SER studio.
This is a great show.
Across the park, 2SER.
And just go for a swim, but like deep.
Come on in, meatball.
Testicles.
Pointing at the door.
Got me more.
Which part is that? Was
I've got a real problem with that.
Bloody. I can stand the prick.
Oh, bloody bird.
Let's not do this.
Oh, the corner injury. She got a corner injury.
Hello and welcome to Across the Park, a show that combines sports and the Golden Globes in what we are calling the Sports Golden Globes, a name which we are very proud of, might I add. My name is Joel and I honestly mean this, Kasim. Unlike last week, this week I'm joined by two co-hosts. First up is a man who went on an actual plane. An actual plane. It's Mick Rad.
Hello! I made it. I survived. I crossed the border.
How was it?
Across the border.
Oh. Hello.
Across the border, yeah.
Your show name?
Yeah, it was good. The plane was pretty full. We all had to wear masks, obs. There was no really good food. It was pretty crap food.
I don't know if boomers are allowed to say obs.
Who's a boomer?
Oh, what are you?
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
No, that's a genuine question.
I'm the best generation, Generation X.
I don't know.
I reckon to Mick does extreme. That to himself every morning in the mirror.
Generation to the extreme.
Good morning, Mick. Generation X.
Yes.
Hang on. Okay, you're saying you're Generation X. I think I'm possibly X as well.
Are you?
Are you? What are you, Y? Or are you X as well? I think we're all X.
I thought I was a millennial.
No.
But this is the thing, and this is what I've just learned recently. I think millennial covers a lot of different things. It covers X,
Y.
We
got confused about that, didn't we?
Yeah. So we're all millennials, Mick?
Yeah, I think I'm closer to that. Than X. I'm actually closer to being a millennial.
But again, I think I just said that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's not do this again.
Also joining us is a woman who's going to tell us all about the red carpet, like what type of fabric it was. It's Gabby Morris.
Hey, guys. It's me on the red carpet, ready to show you all the fashion you're never going to be able to afford. Hang on.
You see that guy at the Golden Globes was wearing a hoodie?
No.
Yeah, because Olivia Wilde broke his heart. They split up.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So all the people
she's dating
really
Harry Styles,
streams,
so and maybe then, he was trying to reach the youth.
Mick, thoughts?
Right. No, I was just saying, like, why they even put him on camera if he was, like, heartbroken and in a hoodie? Just, you know.
I'm totally, like... I have no idea. I mean, they did break up, but I don't know if he's heartbroken. He's probably just really stoned and eating pizza.
That's the Golden Globes is about.
Who says you have to dress up? Is it a thing that you have to dress up? Sure, you can just wear what you want.
Yeah, especially when you're at home and it's zoomed in.
Yeah. I saw literally nothing of the Golden Globes. I don't know anything about it, but you're saying, so they did it all via Zoom.
Well, yeah. So they had Amy Poehler and Tina Fey doing... one who was in New York and one who was in LA, and so they were doing it simultaneously live crossing.
I like your show.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And in the audience was first responders or like, what is it? First responders. Yeah. Not really.
Doctors and nurses?
Yes.
Frontline workers?
Yes, that's what I was thinking. First responder is not that. That's like when someone
first person
responds
to
an emergency.
When like 2SER does a giveaway and the first person to call through gets a prize, that's a first responder.
Yes, exactly. So it was like a bit awkward, but Tina Fey and Amy Poehler did a really good job of saying their lines, like matching. They were bouncing off each other, but from different states. And they were really funny, but it was just a bit awkward because like obviously it was a tiny crowd of like spread out people on these weird little tables. And then the celebrities zooming in, but most of them were like very dressed up, but just sitting by themselves.
Okay.
Like, it was awkward. I mean, I didn't watch really any of it. I just saw some highlights. Mick, did you watch much of it?
No, I didn't see much, just the highlights. But, same. So it was pretty awkward. I don't like these bloody zoomed-in award nights. They're terrible.
Nah.
What happens if someone has won? Do they already have the globe? Or is it... Do they know already?
I don't think they would know.
But do they have it, like, when they say, and the winner is...
No, they don't. No, I didn't see anyone with it.
They'd get it delivered to the door, like, by Uber Eats the next day.
Yeah. Did anyone order a globe?
Okay, well, there you go. Golden Globes chat.
I do know that Marvel are moving the production of their movies to Australia, to Sydney,
yes.
for 5 years.
In 5 years or 4 or 5 years?
4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
like
right.
4 or 5 years, as in like 4 or 5 years, not 4 or 5. Four, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but 4 or 5 years.
So F-O-R, 5 years? Is it 4 or 5 years? Or 4 to 5 years?
Anyway,
or
shut
45
up. If you want
years?
To be, if you want to be an extra in a Marvel movie, now's your time. That's all I'm saying. If you want to get a job on a Marvel film, it's going to be in Sydney for 5 years.
Can
not
that...
4 or 5 years.
Can that be something we try and do on this show? Get the 3 of us.
I love it when we do this.
A Marvel movie? The 3 of us.
We need to look back at all the things that we've said that we were going to do and think it's a great idea and never, ever do them.
That's a show in its own.
Yeah.
The things we've never done. Mick, you went on a plane. How was it?
Yeah, it's good. It's pretty much the same as going on a plane pre-COVID, except you couldn't hear anyone speak properly. Like,
wait, because they were wearing masks, or the microphones are just bad.
You were going to swear.
But the flight attendants they actually have to say on the announcement, the flight attendants will take their masks off as they're showing you how to put the oxygen mask on. Because they're going to add this line now on the planes that if you've got planes going down, the oxygen masks drop down, take off your bloody mask first before you put the oxygen mask on.
Oh, because people are stupid.
Yeah, people are stupid.
Shit.
Yeah, because people are stupid.
That's a whole reprint of all those emergency documents.
Yeah, now you have to be like mask off.
The marketing person would have been like,
thing
God
down.
Damn it, COVID.
Those pictures are always so weird. And like, I think there's one, it might be in one of the European airlines where the baby in the picture
Like
a full human adult face.
Yeah, it's very creepy. I know. It's quite triggering, especially if you've got any type of like anxiety about flying, or you look at that material and you're like, I'm dying. I'm dead. I'm going to die.
Yeah.
So is that baby? Oh my God, we're all going down.
Yeah. Mick, have you ever been on a plane where something's happened and the things have popped down?
Oh, you get a bit of turbulence. It's good fun. It's like an amusement ride.
No.
Where you're going up and down.
No, you're a psycho.
And everyone's, it's when people start screaming that it's the best. Like people start like going, ah, and then you hear like little squeals from the, you know, the people in the plane, that's when you know shit's going down. That's all right. I mean, planes are pretty sturdy, right? They don't go down very often. So when something happens, it's
don't
like a bit
say
of fun.
That, Mick. Knock on wood.
Why?
Come in.
Because that's scary. Didn't you see the engine that just combusted and crashed down in...
Yeah, in America.
Yeah.
Like Donnie Darko. Yeah.
Oh, my God, that's so true.
Can I relate this?
Yes, please.
Oh, yeah. Can I relate this to boomers again, though? as we were leaving Sunshine Coast Airport, my in-laws decided they had to come into the airport to say goodbye. Like, is this a boomer thing, right? Like, we're back in the old days when people went on planes, it was a really rare occurrence. So you'd all go. It was like a big event.
Yeah.
Go into the – have some meals and say goodbye to everyone. You know, you're going on holiday. See you later. We'd been there for like 3 days. And we were going back home and they were all like, we're coming into the airport to say goodbye. It's like, no, just drop us at the front. It's fine. But no, we're coming in. And then they tried coming in and they had to go security. They didn't have their masks with them. And I'm like,
no.
By the time they actually got in, we were already in because the plane was about to go. Like, we seriously had no time. And they're like, made it all the way in. We're like, the plane's boarding. We have to go. And they're like, why did you bother coming into the airport to say goodbye when, you know, we were about
this
to
is
leave
like,
anyway. And
then they're
like,
I'm sweating.
Messages that we're on the... On the tarmac, it's sending messages like, "Oh, we just saw your plane fly into the air." Like, they actually stayed in the airport and watched our plane leave. I mean, what are you doing?
No, what would have been worse? We just decided to get on the plane. We're going to come on the holiday with you.
We're following you.
Oh,
it is weird, especially in a domestic situation. Like,
yes.
You're not flying anywhere far. You're flying to another state.
But, like, the thought of just going to the airport for the sake of going to the airport is so unappealing to me. Like, you go to the airport when you're leaving or you're going traveling. Like, that, the thought of, like, going in and fussing around and dealing with everyone's, like, anxiety, stress about getting to the boarding gate in time. No, why? God.
Yeah.
Get a life. Sorry.
Totally. I don't listen. It's okay.
Yeah. Who does?
How have you been, Gabby?
Good.
Excellent.
Good.
And, oh, that's, yeah, there's more.
Yes, good. Well, not sure if you saw on the socials, but I there was a video of me, a slow motion video of me getting a swish.
Yes.
Basketball swish.
Yep.
Anyway, after posting that, I've done some analytics. People go off for sport. That got a lot of feedback.
Okay.
So we've got to do more videos of us doing sporty things.
In slow motion?
Slow motion adds an extra, you know, like a little bit of a pizzazz. It keeps people watching, keeps them on their toes. Will it go in? Won't it go in? It will. It's Gabby. It's a swish. Boom.
Nice. Well, I'm all for that. I'm all for us doing slow motion sports videos.
Well, you just don't really think people are into sport. And then you do that and you're like, okay, people are into it.
Yeah.
Isn't this the whole reason we do this podcast, show, is because...
Is
sport
it?
Is popular in this country. Yeah, around the world. Everyone bloody loves it.
The show or sport?
It's hard to know. We don't get any feedback, but when you post something, you know, you get the feedback. You feel it from the fans.
What we really need is a segment this year where we do sporting challenges or we do something and we take videos and we post them.
Like, I love it. We've said this many times.
This is good brainstorming right now.
Yeah, we just added the list of things we're not going to do. But no, this week I'm going to try and do a slow motion video of me doing some sort of sport.
Love it.
Okay?
Love it.
Ooh.
That's what.
Mick can do a slow motion video of him drinking a beer.
Yeah. We're watching him on Zoom.
People can't see that right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, excellent. So, sport. I'm just going to say this now. We've had to move studios from our normal studio because of some issues here at 2SER. Nothing major. Everything's fine. Calm down, everyone, because everything's fine. Everyone's going to be okay. We've just had to pop into another studio just for a little bit.
Oh, Joel, you're a bit flustered.
I'm a little bit flustered. But we are in a different studio and I haven't got all my normal stings and stuff. So
Joel.
I can't do like a sport.
Sport!
Like that. In cricket, Australia won their first game of the T20 series against New Zealand after being outplayed in Christchurch and then again in Dunedin. Aaron Finch, Glenn Maxwell and Ashton Agar had all been highlighted as Australia's underperformers, yet it was those three who led Australia to the 64-run win. Glenn Maxwell top-scored in a game-changing innings that saw him go from 10 runs off 11 balls to 70 off 31 in basically just him smashing the ball around the park. Finch scored his first half century in 8 T20s, and Agar was the man of the match because he took 3 wickets in 5 balls and then finished with 6 for 30.
I don't know what any of that means, but I'm here for the fun.
Okay, while we're on cricket, can I bring up my story?
Absolutely.
If it's...
Gab, I've got a question for you. If you're a bowler in cricket, what is the best thing you can do?
Rub it on your pants. Or if you've got sandpaper, rip that out.
Oh my God. No, like as far as taking wickets goes, like what would be a really good thing you could do as a bowler?
What do you mean thing? What do you mean?
Well,
this is vague.
Okay. A bowler, one of the best things you can do as a bowler is get 3 wickets and 3 balls, right? A hat trick.
And 3 balls. So a wicket's when you hit the ball against the wickets?
Or get caught or run out.
Like, and what's a ball? what does it mean when you get a ball? You said 3 wickets
and 3
balls.
We've really got to teach you about cricket. Anyway, the other question is, as a batter, what is the best thing you can do as a batter? The highest score you can get in one hit is a 6, okay? That'll help.
Yeah, so you just got to hit for 6.
And if you have an over of 6 balls,
what is an over?
What would be the best thing a batter could do in 6 overs, in 6 balls, in 1 over?
Get all the 6s on the 6.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a guess.
I mean, you didn't say it well.
Get 6 for 6.
Yeah, basically.
6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 6 give me your 60,
and, 60. And maths, or 6 times 6.
No, don't do this to me. I'm already sweating. I refuse. I'm literally, I knew you were going to do maths. I can't handle it. It's Friday. Oh my God, now I'm getting really stressed.
The reason I ask these questions,
I'm getting my calculator
is because in one game, one T20 game this week, both of those things happened.
36.
Very rare things to happen in cricket.
Very rare. Okay, how
did
rare?
Did you just look it up on your
phone?
No,
I didn't look it up.
Oh, my God.
I wrote it down. Quick maths. So, hang on.
The times tables listen, on the back listen, of your toilet
listen.
Door when you're
this is
up?
Not – don't shame anyone, all right? So I want to understand, how rare is it? Is it as rare as a plane going down, or is it as rare as Joel getting a girlfriend?
Okay, so in T20, in 2020 cricket, there's only 15 bowlers that have got a hat-trick. So, you know, that's hat-tricks are pretty rare in like
T20.
Test cricket,
what about the English one?
In one in T20, it's a bit more often. Test cricket's the long one, the five-day one. But hitting six sixes in one over is very rare. And this, I don't think it's ever happened in Test cricket, I'm pretty sure.
Joel?
And I think there's only been three people that have ever done it in all forms of the game. So this guy, the irony is, and the funny thing is, the same guy that got the hat-trick is the guy that got six balls hit for six in one over. So it all, like, turned around. He got these three wickets, thought he was a legend, and then all of a sudden gets tonked for six sixes in one over. Look, I think this is one of the most amazing cricket things that's ever happened ever.
Cricket things. He keeps saying cricket things.
I get what you're saying, Mick. This is very – it's very rare for both of those things to happen, let alone happen in one game. Is that what you're trying to say?
Let alone to the same bowler.
Or to the same bowler, yeah. Do you know who the batter was?
Oh, yeah. He's a West Indian guy, Kieran Pollard.
Oh, it's Kieran Pollard.
It was Sri Lanka versus West Indies.
Okay.
How come it's just, like, not all over the news if it's so special?
Well, it,
it is, Gabby. You're just not looking at the news. Did you research the show at all?
That is a stupid
frustration.
Question.
It's like the first thing that came up when I searched.
I don't search cricket. What did you search?
Oh, sports news.
I'm not getting it. I'm just not. It knows my algorithms. It's not. It's not finding me.
All right.
Oh boy. Anyway.
Anyway.
I thought it was a good story, but you know.
No, I like that.
I'm sure the listeners enjoyed it.
No, it's good.
Well, in more cricket news, in England are versing India in a few Test matches. That's the five-day one. Normally goes for 5 days. India wrapped up an extraordinary 10-wicket victory against England inside 2 days as both sides' spinners caused mayhem, Seamick, on a treacherous wicket in the day-night third Test. 17 wickets fell. He's not listening. Yeah. Hi. 17 wickets fell in Thursday's first two sessions, with 30 falling in 2 days.
What do you mean when they fall?
So 30 people got out in 2 days.
Okay. Yeah.
Normally the game goes for 5 days.
Right.
And you won't.
Quick game.
Very quick game. Basically, that's what I'm saying. It hasn't happened.
In Test cricket, a quick game is not a good game. You know that theory where quick game is a good game? No, not in cricket.
Nah.
But this one, this hasn't happened since 1935 that a game has been this short. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. I'm glad everyone else did.
I blame T20. I blame 2020 cricket.
Really?
Myself.
It was all the spinners though. Game. It wasn't. It was just the pitch. It wasn't the batters. Like just trying to belt.
I just like blaming 2020 for everything.
Oh, that's fair.
If I trip over like a little thing on the. On the footpath, I blame 2020.
Bloody cricket. T20. Well, the NRL season starts next week, so I guess next week we'll be doing.
Holy
some
shit!
Sort of,
is this our preview episode?
No, that'll be next week. I swear. God, that's loud.
That is so loud. I'm just trying to look for more cricket news, but I can't.
No, I think we've covered it. I think next week we might do a little bit of a what do you call it? Preview. We'll do a preview of the 2021 season.
Wow, it's already happening.
Yeah.
God, here we go.
Well, it's not cricket anymore.
True.
Is there any sport you do like, Gabby?
There is, and it's tennis. Australia's Alexei Popyrin has won his first ATP Tour final by beating Alexander Bublik.
Oh.
Public?
Mm-hmm.
Public.
Yeah.
I'll run with that. In the Singapore Open decider, Popperin defeated Bublik 4-6, 6-0, 6-2 in the final. Ooh. This puts him 82nd in the world, meaning in the men's we now have 5 of the top 100 seeded players. He's behind Alex Diminor, John Millman,
Nick Kyrgios,
and Jordan Thompson.
And wait, what number is Nick? 8.
Well, stick around because that might be in the quiz.
Oh, gonna Google
it. Yeah.
Oh my god. Joking, I won't. I promise I won't. Phone's on the table.
Yes, it is. Anyone else have tennis news? No? No?
Nah.
Okay.
Ellen Perez update. She's in Guadalajara in Mexico. She had some amazing tacos in quarantine there. Like, they gave her like a make at home taco kit. And then, like, she made it all herself. It's awesome. Look at her Instagram. I'm so obsessed with Ellen now. Sorry.
Oh.
Well, there you go.
No, not that way. Like,
No. Not in that way. But just, like, it's just, yeah, it's funny. Ellen Perez is...
She's very, very good.
Yeah. Australian professional tennis player. She came out here for the Australian Open, was in quarantine for 2 weeks. You can listen to the episode on all your streaming choices, Spotify, Apple, et cetera. Yeah.
You also have to mention she was on our show.
I'm getting there because I'm saying you can watch it. Watch it.
Yeah, she was on our show a few weeks ago and we haven't lived it down because we keep talking about it.
I know. It's so now we're just talking about what she eats. It's so freaking creepy. Like, come on, Nick.
You wait. Every week is going to be an Ellen Perez update.
Now we're going to make a sting for that.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Okay,
I'll
take growl, care. Please. Your things are the best. In AFL, after calling over 1,000 games, AFL commentator Bruce McAvaney has announced he will be hanging up the mic 3 weeks out from the season opener. He will continue with all the horsey racing stuff, and he's part of the Olympics team, along with us. Yeah. But the 67-year-old says he's done calling the AFL. He's been doing it for so long that... But when he started, it wasn't called AFL.
Australian what?
Sensational.
VFL.
Oh.
Mm.
Wow. He doesn't really look that old, does he?
I don't know if that's true, though. I should have fact checked that.
Okay. Well, don't believe anything we say on this show. Classic.
Mick, thoughts on Bruce McAvaney?
You don't want to know my thoughts on Bruce McAvaney. Oh. But, look, I'm not a huge fan of his commentary, never have been, but that's okay because I met him once. I was at the Australian Embassy doing the AFL Grand Final. He came up and bought a meat pie from me and he was very nice.
Were you serving meat pies or were you just eating one? And he was like, I'll give you $5 for that pie.
I was in the Australian Embassy in Washington, D.C. Bruce McAvaney was there on AFL Grand Final day. And I was selling meat pies and sausage rolls as part of the embassy and he bought one off me. Well, actually, I think I just gave it to him. And, yeah, we had a nice chat and he was friendly. So, look, decent guy. I think he's a really passionate sports guy. But I don't know. I don't really like his commentary much.
Interesting.
So, yeah, you asked for all of my opinion.
It is interesting.
You got it.
Yeah, I love that. Great story.
I'm just so hopeful that someone just turned on the radio and put on 107.3 at that time when Mick was telling a story about giving Bruce McAvaney a pie. It's the best content.
It is true. That is actually so true.
It's so great. I mean, I haven't, so I can't.
No. You know, I've only just seen him badly dancing at his daughter's wedding. That's about it.
Oh. I mean, that's kind of pretty good.
I wasn't at the wedding.
Oh. Gabby just peering through a window at someone's wedding. I think that's Bruce McAvaney dancing.
Oh, shit.
Okay.
It was a viral video. It's just a long story that's not necessary.
Sure. In soccer news over in the EPL, I don't know if you guys saw this, a ref has had an absolute shocker of a game.
Oh.
Brighton versus West Bromwich.
Oh, I think I saw this, yeah.
Mick, did you see this?
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay. So West Brom are up 1-0 and Brighton receive a penalty outside the box, okay? So everyone can be everywhere. It doesn't matter. It's not just goalie versus... the kicker person. And the guy who's about to take the penalty shot says to the ref, can I kick now? And the ref just blows his whistle. So the guy kicks it, curves it, goes in the back of the net, right at the bottom on the right-hand side. That's not how you describe a goal. And then, but as the ball was like going in, he blew the whistle again to say stop, which is too late. And then everyone's like rushing over to him, asking him questions, getting in his face, and he gets very flustered and he walks around clearly not knowing what to do. And then he says, no goal, do it again, do it again. And then they're like blowing up. And then someone in his ear says, no, it's a goal. You blew the whistle. So he goes, oh, okay, sorry.
Oh, goal, no. Goal. Oh, God.
Blows it a goal. Everyone starts going back, blows the whistle again, says, nah, no goal. We have to just check it again. And they go to the VAR, and then the VAR says, no goal. So he had to do it again.
No.
It was such a like.
But why would the VAR say no goal?
I don't know. Yeah, it was a very weird call because he clearly blew the whistle. It was fine to kick.
What?
Yeah.
Because VAR screws it up every time.
But it wasn't VAR. It was this num-mum not doing a very good job.
Yep, pretty much.
num-mum.
I don't know. I just made that one up. But maybe his bum was numb. He was flustered.
No, but VAR is a blight on the game of soccer. But
VAR has no context in that situation.
Called...
No, it shouldn't.
Well, I know, but they overruled it. They said it was no goal. It should have been a goal.
Yeah. While we're on the subject of video refereeing, there was a similar story in the cricket in the Marsh One Day Cup where an umpire, this has never happened before, the ball was bowled and a guy completely missed it. The wicketkeeper went up saying he caught it and the umpire gave it out and then thought about it for a second, then changed his mind. Like he was his own video ref. Anyway, again, thought that was interesting. Surfing. I mean, it wasn't a joke, but I'm glad you guys liked it.
I honestly didn't even know what you were saying. It was like a different language.
I'm not sure I know what I was saying either. Hopefully it was a joke. Hopefully when I listen back, it came through as a joke. Because Mick seems to think so. He's lost it. All right.
Oh, God.
And just before we get to... we do have surfing news, but we also have to... no time. We'll do it next week. Surfers have come to Australia for
the
World Surf League.
Yep.
And they're all in quarantine.
Yep.
Game time. It's tennis questions. Here we go. All right. So, like I said before, what did I say before? Oh, the top five, Australian top five men. Okay. So, guess their numbers. Alex Diminor.
One.
Well, he's not number one in the world, no. We would know that.
240.
No, it's a... You guys weren't listening. Top 100. They're all top 100, okay?
Oh, he's getting cranky.
So pick a number between zero or no, between 2 and 100.
2 and 100.
Yes.
Who's number one?
It's like Novak Djokovic, I think, is number one, isn't he? He's not Australian, so it doesn't matter. Alex
right,
Diminor.
Okay, 76.
Wrong.
82.
Wrong. 23. John Milman.
And these you are can't going, get annoyed at us for this.
These are going up.
This
I'm
game
annoyed
is
about
literally
everything.
Ridiculous.
I'm annoyed about this show. I want to start again.
Oh, we can.
No. Oh, they're going up. Okay, so you're saying
so,
Diminor is the highest ranked Australian.
Yes, okay. Thank you. 23. So John Milman, he's in the 30s.
Okay, 38.
Okay.
Wrong.
You love saying that.
What did you say, Mick?
39.
Yes.
Fuck. Oh,
no, Gabby.
Yes. That's
where. How about
Nick Kyrgios? He's like.
In the 40s. In the 40s.
Is he? 42.
Nope.
48.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes.
And Jordan Thompson.
Stupid. 52.
It's in the 50s.
If you get this, Mick, I swear to God. He's Googling it. That's
where. To God. Come on, Mick.
Oh, is it 50s? 55.
No, it's 50. And if you're listening, Ali, it doesn't matter. The show's finished. I want to go home.
All right. Well, next week we'll do a preview of the NRL for 2021.
Happy Mardi Gras, everyone.
Happy Mardi Gras.
I'm about to go get my gay on.
Yeah.
Cocktails without the cuck.
It's not a product. It's a technology.
It's an education challenge.
A regenerative suspension.
There will be a growing demand for industrial photovoltaics.
Pumped hydro.
Innovation in the financing space.
The high-speed train is in all our interests.
All political lines.
Australia is a solar paradise.
The market is moving much faster than that.
You've got something that's transformational.
Solar window in a can.
Beyond Zero. Global warming science, solutions and action.
Taking it to a do-it-yourself level.
Hello. Thanks for joining me, Kay Wenigle, and Carly Dober, to another edition of the Beyond Zero show. We're coming to you from the studios of 3CR Melbourne, syndicated around Australia on the Community Radio Network, and podcast on the internet on 3cr.org.au. In Australia, and of course elsewhere, we're all grappling with the overwhelming issues, including climate change and pandemics. So to try and make sense of it all, we're speaking today with Dr. Shweta Chakraborty, most recently the Associate Director at the Institute of Science for Global Policy in Washington, D.C. She is a risk and cognitive behavioural scientist and is recognised as an expert communicator who helps household decision makers better understand the existing and emerging risks and to be better prepared to thrive on a rapidly changing planet. Hi, Shweta. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Firstly, you train as a cognitive behavioural scientist. What got you interested in this area?
That's a great question. And I get asked that pretty frequently, especially by students who are curious about what subjects in STEM to pursue. And I always say, you know, science encompasses social science and hard sciences, but these are integral to actually solving some of the biggest global challenges we face as collective citizens of the planet. And so cognitive behavioral science is a fascinating social science. It falls under the umbrella of behavioral science. And to be quite frank, when I started studying it, I had no idea what it was. It just sounded cool. So that was kind of my cop out of still, you know, being a scientist, but ultimately pursuing the aspect of science that I truly enjoyed, which was understanding human behavior. And that's really what it is. How are our brains wired? How do we perceive information? How do we perceive statistics, facts, evidence that comes our way? And how does that compare to the reality of the evidence and the statistics and the facts? And why does that not match up? Consistently, it's been found that there is a overreaction to certain information that people receive and underreactions to other information. And it's that gap that just fascinated me. And trying to close that gap in overreacting to things that we shouldn't be so worried about, like eating non-organic foods, for example, and underreacting to things that we really should be concerned about, like sea level rise or the potential for wildfires all year round, I made it my career to understanding that gap and closing it.
That's really fascinating because obviously we're seeing a lot of this with climate change, and there's phrases such as cognitive dissonance being thrown around and compared to our flight and fight response. Can you explain what those terms are and why they're so different?
What's interesting about the way our brains are wired is that we resemble our ancestors from, you know, thousands of years ago, much more than we do the supercomputers that we're designing to address some of these really complex interconnected problems that we're facing, like climate change and its many ripple effects. For example, the emergence of infectious disease like COVID-19. These are really massive, complex problems. And, you know, we need artificial intelligence. We need supercomputers to really grasp how to prioritize our resources in addressing some of these and solving some of these. But our human brains, alas, still operate as though we're in a very simple risk landscape where our biggest issue is coming across, you know, being separated from our community or our tribe, coming across a snake or a tiger, and having to make a snap decision in that moment to either respond or to run away. That's still how we're wired. So we're in this constant conflict between fighting our innate intrinsic human nature and our response to different risks that emerge versus the really thoughtful process that needs to be put in place so we can actually make better, more informed decisions that are more aligned to the reality of the risk landscape that we live in now and we operate in now. So this is really where we're finding ourselves in this modern period of time, where we've advanced so quickly as a species. We've set up communities, we've, you know, processed so much innovation, and we've come so far in terms of just human ingenuity and our ability to harness and utilize technology. But the downside of that, the dark side of that, is the inability to then catch up to how are we going to also address the dual nature of some of these advances. So like the nefarious outcomes, how those can be used, how those can be manipulated, and the negative impacts or the adverse impacts that have taken their toll on our environment and our collective ability to be healthy and make good decisions for ourselves, for our families. So we're constantly in a state of fighting our nature, and there's ways to do it. And that's what the field of behavioral science and me specifically are attempting to do, is to understand the brain and use that information to communicate better, so we can overcome some of that intrinsic wiring and get closer to those supercomputers that we're designing.
So when we look at what our response worldwide has been to the COVID crisis, and admittedly it's been different from country to country, we have, as people, responded to the COVID crisis more quickly than we've responded to the climate change crisis. Why is that different?
So there's a lot of overlap in how we perceive risks related to climate change, and actually how we've perceived the risk related to COVID. And there's some unique distinctions as well. So we have subliminal factors that influence our perceptions of risk. And we attribute higher frequency and probability of risk to, based on some of these subliminal cues. One good example, there's many, many that have been found over decades now of research. One I use as an example is, how available is that particular risk to people? How quickly can they recall the risk? How salient is it? That's another interchangeable word for how available it is. And so that is why, for example, sensational risks that we've seen in recent years, like terrorist attacks or active shooter events or wildfires, the images that we see around these wildfires in Australia and the US and in Brazil, these are more salient because they're so immediately accessible to our brain, because they have been covered so much by the media, and because they're just images you can't forget. That then results in increased probability and frequency of thinking that that risk is going to occur again. So we actually overestimate the risk of terrorist attacks. We overestimate the risk of active shooters for that reason. That's one example. Other examples include, how likely is a risk to disproportionately impact vulnerable communities like children or the elderly? How endemic is the risk? How much do we know about the risk? Have we seen it before? Is it brand new? All of these different factors, and there's a great matrix that actually outlines them all, that shows the different risk perception, the different factors that feed into our perceptions of risk. Based on that, then you can start to create a profile of how people are going to respond and react. So if you think about climate change as a whole, it's not surprising that people are underreacting to it as a whole. Again, now something like wildfires, because it's so salient, we're seeing an increased fear, an increased perception of risk that's more aligned to the reality. But climate change generally, especially up until this most recent past 5 years, which has been the hottest 5 years in recorded history, climate change was perceived, because of all these various inputs I just described, as a problem that was very slow moving. That's another perception cue. Something that was impacted other people, not me. So it's a them, not us. These are problems that are way in the future, nothing immediate that we have to worry about. So all of those factors played into why climate change was not accurately perceived. Then something like COVID-19, it is novel, it's new, it's invisible, it is disproportionately impacting the elderly. All of these cues then resulted in a reaction that initially was perceived by many as an overreaction, because it had all of those elements that we would know from the behavioral science discipline would actually predict that people would react with fear. And that's what we saw happen. And initially there was hope, especially at a global governance level, that maybe that was an overreaction, that we could contain it, that it wasn't going to reach the levels of epidemic that it really did. But ultimately, as we see, that it wasn't, in fact, an underreaction. And I don't have the data still, and I think it's going to take some time for us to do a thorough cost-benefit analysis to look at the real base rate statistics of COVID-19 and its relationship to the perception of risk around COVID-19. But it looks as though there was an initial reaction that was fear. And ultimately, unfortunately, due to poor governance, it did play out to people's fears. People's initial fears actually turned out, unfortunately, to be, depending on who you're talking to, of course, turned out to be pretty accurate in terms of just how devastating this disease has been for our global, collective global society.
Shatha, 2020, as you have been saying, was an incredibly eventful year in terms of political unrest and global scaffolding crises. Can you please talk to the five pillars of risk that you advise governments about?
Sure. So I look at climate change as the threat multiplier for many other risks. So all of those risks still exist. For example, overpopulation, food security, water scarcity, infectious disease. Those risks exist on their own, but climate change, the planet warming, is exacerbating all of that. And that is something that is very difficult for people to comprehend because, again, as we said from the beginning, our brains really are limited. Our brains really aren't designed for that level of complexity. And our representatives are representing public citizens, and they have the same brains. So to expect that your civil servants in your respective country have any more capacity for understanding that type of risk and complexity is not true. We're all still humans, first and foremost. And so we have to treat government officials in the same way that we treat the public. So we have to communicate to the public why attention, priorities, resources, personnel, all of it needs to be maybe not intuitively aligned to some of what we're trying to do at a more wider governance level. Because again, people are going to want to protect their immediate interests because people aren't designed to think far into the future. Thinking about being proactive and preparing against these kinds of things like climate change and its impacts like sea level rise is really low down the priority list. So the goal is to change that. And that's what I do.
We're speaking with Washington-based risk and behavioral scientist, Dr. Shetha Chakraborty.
We have to communicate to the public so that there is support from the public behind prioritizing different global risks and attention to global risks. And then at the same time, we have to push policy forward in a way that is aligned, again, to the reality of what we're facing. And we have to convince officials that even though this doesn't seem immediate, without being proactive and preparing for it, we are talking about what is billions of dollars now, and I'm not saying that's cheap, but billions of dollars now in protecting ourselves against sea level rise, against another infectious disease outbreak, will save us trillions in the future. And that's what I do when I advise governments, and whether we're talking about, you know, my country, the United States, or even at a global level, I work very closely with country delegations and colleagues all over the world. We need top down and we need bottom up because ultimately it has to reinforce itself.
Fascinating. You mentioned mitigating for sea level rise. So with regards to managing these risks, such as sea level rise, what would citizens see or experience when these risks are not adequately managed?
Yeah, and that's what keeps me up at night, right? Is people aren't thinking even 20, 30 years into the future. So right now we are on track to reach 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels by 2050. That's in 30 years. That's within the lifetime of most people's mortgage cycles. And the Paris Accords 5 years ago in 2015 stated that we have to stop and stabilize at 1.5 degrees warmer than pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. So not only is that not happening, we're on a fast track to that by mid-century. So ultimately, without thinking about what the world is going to look like and preventing the worst case scenarios from coming true, that's bad enough, but we're also not preparing for the reality of what we're locked into. No matter what we do, no matter what our best efforts are, the world will be 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer at a minimum, no matter what, and sooner than we expect. And people need to know what that looks like and feels like for their day to day. So that is what's so critical about getting this information out there, is so people can be truly prepared in terms of the decisions, how their decisions are going to be impacted by that new landscape that they're going to be living in and doing business in and raising their children in. It's going to impact every decision in everyday people's lives. From, but what does this mean for your access and availability to water? What does it mean for the food you will have access to? All of these things are really relevant, and we have not even come close to start thinking about really adapting to it.
You write and you speak a lot about the rebuilding of public trust being crucial to address both expected and unexpected operational and potential future risks, one of them obviously being the climate crisis. How do you think public health officials begin to rebuild trust in scientific and health institutions?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's ultimately why we are in the situation we're in, where for some reason, non-experts, non-scientists are being taken at their word as if they had spent their careers studying the realities of some of these issues. And yet they are being higher regarded than scientists, experts. Like, for example, COVID-19, we have public health experts, we have epidemiologists, we have virologists, we have infectious disease people who have spent their life studying this stuff. And yet that so much of the advice has been put to the side and politics has taken over. And why is that happening? That is a real modern day case study of distrust in science, which is resulting in things like public health or infectious disease or medical, anything like medical science has historically been removed from politicization. And yet here we are, and we're seeing it in real time. And that really is, it's an unfortunate reality of where, for example, I can use the U.S. as a microcosm of a bigger picture of the world, which is that there is this digging in of people's identities, and it's really proven very poignant in the United States. Never in the history of the United States, for example, so I'm using this as a case study example, would you be able to say that just because somebody identifies in one political end of the spectrum or the other, that based on that alone, you could also say with real likelihood what their stance on climate change is, what their stance on wearing masks are, where they fall in terms of Black Lives Matter, the protest movement we had here in the United States that's still continuing, but really happened in the summer of 2020. These things have all become correlated because they've become part of this integral identity to an individual, where if you are a conservative, let's say, in the United States, then you also don't take climate change seriously. You also don't think wearing masks is helpful. You don't take COVID-19 efforts to curb the disease seriously. All of these things have become so integral to people's identities to the point where it's extremely dangerous. I witness it myself as somebody who goes on air. I'm a scientist, I'm apolitical, and yet I'm forced to say whether or not I'm a conservative scientist or a liberal scientist. I mean, that's ridiculous. Why is there an adjective in front of scientist? But it's what's happened because people have really dug in their heels and have committed to their tribal identities. And that's something that is a survival instinct in us that we can trace back to the beginning of human evolution as to why we have those tendencies to do so. We have a lot of work to do to build trust back into science. And that's something that I do work on day in and day out. And it's really a hard thing to do, but necessary.
Absolutely. It's interesting, a lot of the communication and messaging in Australia about action towards climate change is dominated by politicians and the fossil fuel industry, who are talking about protecting those workers, protecting jobs, talking about jobs and economic growth. So we're already seeing that Australia and other countries around the world are spending hundreds of billions in post-disaster recovery. I'd like to know about which sectors we are not hearing about. So which sectors are traditionally discussed together or not discussed when talking about climate mitigation? And what is the financial impact that we're not considering when we discuss moving towards a more sustainable economy?
So we need to talk about the impact of climate change from a financial perspective, because that is what resonates with a lot of populations, whether I mean the conservatives in the US is definitely a key example of that, but that's true for those who are in more traditional sectors around the world, because this looks like an attack on people's way of life or what has become comfortable, what people have become used to, and we don't do well with that either. Remember, humans are living longer than they ever have, but ultimately there wasn't that much change in the lifespan of a human. And again, that's how our brains are wired. So that amount of change can be very jarring and there's a lot of dissonance and resistance that creeps up because of that. So the way to get people to care about overhauls in sector and the economy is by framing it as such. And people wonder why people don't care. People seem to not care about their grandchildren's future, right? Especially those who aren't acting or moving on climate. But what about your grandkids? Well, it's not that they don't care. We all care about our children and our grandchildren. And that's the one thing we really do have in common worldwide. But again, our brains aren't wired really to think about that far into the future. So even if you can say you'll love your grandchildren, but you can't necessarily comprehend the risks that they're going to be facing, much less even this, we're talking about 30 years in the future for people. And that's hard to believe, much less thinking about what your grandchildren's future and 30 years ahead for them is going to look like. But framing it economically is really helpful, especially for those who are in positions of power to make decisions, because then those really are numbers that work with groups to say that here's a better financial future for you. And then to really look at where is there room for innovation? What are the sectors that are the worst polluters, truly? And that is transportation. It is agriculture. It is energy. It's these heavy industries. It's cement, steel. And again, business as usual has worked for so long. What needs to happen is to create the minimum disruption to people's lives and making it economically pleasing to make the switch and to reduce the amount of friction in making the switch. So ultimately, a lot of these sectors, some will be slower than others, but the ones that can adopt faster can and should, and we just have to reduce the friction in letting that happen.
You've talked about the gold standard for risk communication is to ensure that normative analysis identifying the information most relevant to the specific choices facing recipients has been conducted prior to any communication effort. Do you have any examples where this standard has been met and how that's benefited a country?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, this work has been done in healthcare, and I started my career in healthcare. So I was curious as to why there are still such bad patient outcomes, despite us having solved so many of these disease states. And yet you're still seeing the number one killer of humans worldwide as, you know, cardiovascular disease, for example. And yet we know everything there is to know in terms of how to be more proactive and better prepared for preventing this type of outcome, like a heart attack or a stroke. And yet you still have people who don't prescribe to the treatment regimens that doctors put forward for them. And I was so curious as to how that is still possible, despite all of our expertise and our knowledge. And this is where a lot of the initial research in the field of behavioral science and effective communication started and came from. You know, first and foremost, you need to map people's mental models, understand what their perceptions are compared to the reality of risks that they face, and then correcting for that. So that's the gold standard. And it's expensive in that it's a lot of work to talk to individuals. And I completely can appreciate that. But it's not as expensive as trying to find a technology solution for everything as well. There's many solutions at our fingertips. We want to keep them all on the table. But all I'm saying is that there are cost-effective ways that innovations in behavioral science have found that tweak how we approach different issues and problems. And those behavioral outcomes can result in really much better outcomes for people overall. Whether we're talking about health outcomes or we're talking about adaptation to climate change, there is a lot of potential for human behavioral change but through effective communication. And we're only on the tip of the iceberg in exploring it.
What are some more of the psychological barriers that would prevent people from being open to discussing the consequences of climate change and the other areas of risks that you've identified?
Many of the risks that people are underreacting to that aren't getting people's attention tend to just not be immediate enough, close enough. It's somebody else's problem in somebody else's backyard. And then we also, here's a concept that I'm happy to introduce as well to your audiences if they don't know it, called psychic numbing, which is the larger an issue gets or a problem gets, the more numb we become to it. And so an example of that is when you see charity organizations appealing for donations. And this is, you'll notice now, if you watch these commercials on television, wherever you are in the world, that it'll usually now be a one story that is being shared on this commercial. One individual child that is struggling for food or for water, or one individual animal that is really being focused in on, because we don't do well with more numbers of people or more numbers of suffering animals, we turn off because we fear that we as individuals will not be able to do anything. It's just too big of a problem. But if it's one individual, then there's maybe something we can do also as one individual. And so it's actually incredible. The second you add a second child into one of these commercials or a third, you start seeing a noticeable drop in donations. So think about that for a second. That doesn't seem very intuitive, right? The more suffering, the less we're willing to do and give. But it's true. This is how our brains are wired. We have developed as small communities, which is why trust is so important. We tended to know the 50, 100, 150 max our ancestors created when we started setting up civilizations. And that's what we're wired for. Beyond that just gets too complex for our brains to handle. So in addition to something like bigger numbers resulting in a immobilization of being able to do anything, we also have this, well, these are risks or issues or problems that I can't see that are too far away. So, but the good news is we know that. We know that smaller numbers work. So good. Let's change our communications. Let's tell the story about the one child, right? And let's get people to act because of it. Let's make climate change more immediate. Let's make it more salient. So it's things like that. So the more we know, the more we can intervene and become better aligned to the reality of the risks. So there is hope in this. It's not all doom and gloom.
Sheta, thank you so much for your time. We've taken up so much of it. But where can people find out more about this?
The group I work for, We Don't Have Time, it's a completely accessible online platform that's totally free to use. It's being created to be able to get individuals who want to do something and act on the climate urgently connected to one another. So whether you are living in Melbourne, Australia, or Sweden, Stockholm, Sweden, you can set up a page on this profile. It's basically like a Facebook for climate change, right? You can connect with other individuals. And the goal for us is to identify good actions that are being taken, efforts that are underway. So it's critical that we all play our role.
Hear, hear. So that's We Don't Have Time.
That's right. Yes. WeDon'tHaveTime.org. I appreciate what you're doing as well. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Really, really appreciate your time and your amazing efforts too.
Thank you, Kay. Thank you, Carly.
What a fascinating discussion that was with Dr. Sheta Chakraborty, the Washington-based risk and behavioral scientist. If you'd like to find out more about what we discussed, check out the BZE podcast. The Beyond Zero Science and Solutions show is brought to you by the climate change solutions think tank, Beyond Zero Emissions, and is recorded in the studios of 3CR Melbourne and syndicated around Australia on the Community Radio Network. Previous episodes of the show are available on iTunes and Stitcher, so please subscribe to help others find the show. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again next week.
It's not a product, it's a technology.
It's an education challenge.
A regenerative suspension.
There will be a growing demand for industrial photovoltaics.
Pumped hydro.
Innovation in the financing space.
The high-speed train is in all our interests.
All political lines.
Australia is a solar paradise.
The market is moving much faster than that.
You've got something that's transformational.
Solar window in a can.
Beyond Zero. Global warming science, solutions and action.
Taking it to a...
Go.